reach the Outrider Podcast.
Hello, and welcome to episode 22 of the Outrider Podcast. I am Jason Quinn Malott. Today on the show, we have my friend Andrea Portes. Andrea is the author of the novel Hick and the novel Bury This, which is from Soft Skull Press, and a brand new YA novel that just came out at the beginning of September called Anatomy of a Misfit. If you haven't read any of those, you should run out and get them all now. Hick is wonderful. It's brilliant. A little startling if you're a guy. Bury This is really good. I'm in the middle of it. So if you've read it, don't tell me how it ends. Even though it's, you know, based on facts and I can go and find out roughly. Anyway, don't tell me. And of course, Anatomy of a Misfit, which by the time you're listening to this, I will have picked up from the bookstore because I got called the other day and told that my order had arrived and it's waiting for me on the shelf. I occasionally do venture into young adult because I have a couple of friends who have written young adult novels and, you know, you've got to go out and support them. And it's kind of been one of those little eye-opening experiences for me. So a little shout out there, you, to Mr. Brian Ferry and a few other people. Who else? I can't remember off the top of my head because I want to get out of this intro because I'm too much into the stumbling and the bumbling and the and I'm not good at this extemporaneous speaking in an empty room. I do much better talking to other people. So let's get right to my conversation with Andrea Portes.
Hello?
Hi, Andrea.
Hi.
This is Jason.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing well. I'm actually kind of nervous to hear your version of the story on how we met.
No. I mean, come on. It's so funny. It's so good.
It is.
Are we on right now or are we?
Yeah, we're okay. On right now.
Okay. I'll be sure to watch myself.
Oh, no, go ahead. Swear away. I think I've told the story at least once before on the podcast, so I'm going to let you tell it. And I will, even though no one can see it, sit here and hide my face.
Oh, okay, good. Okay, so, no, this is all I really remember, because wasn't this in 2007?
Yes.
Yeah, yep. So 2007, there we are, and Hick had just come out, Hick was just out. Mm-hmm. My debut novel, as they say. And Hick was a semi-autobiographical novel. Semi-autobiographical. And you sort of went on this rant about how you hated the fact that, like, everything had to be autobiographical, and that was, like, so ridiculous and all this stuff. And then, like, there was a pause, and then I was like, yeah, my book is semi-autobiographical. There was just, like, so ridiculous. But you know what? What's funny is everything that you were saying, which is that, you know, the fact that there's this push is true. I mean, Hick mm-hmm. was, I would say, you know, there was a lot of fiction in Hick. I mean, a lot. And,
oh, yeah.
And it was just kind of inspired by my life. But what happened, and I didn't have a problem like that with Bury This because it was about somebody else's story. It was inspired mm-hmm. by somebody else's story. But also that was a lot of fiction too. And then Anatomy of a Misfit is fiction, but it's based on real life events that happened to me that, you know, right. People can Google and see the tragedy, but which is true. I mean, there's tragic events in that, but like the pressure to say that something is autobiographical mm-hmm. is a big deal because publishers, they want that to help sell the book. So,
right.
You know, I mean, so I think a lot of authors are kind of pressured into saying something as, you know, you just have to be very firm, like, no, it's semi-autobiographical, you know, it's
right,
inspired,
right.
But it's not, you know, it's not nonfiction, you know?
Right.
So anyway.
In my defense, I think what uh-huh. I was really upset about
uh-huh.
was because what we were sitting there, it was in, you know, we were sitting there at the dinner thing after the Midwest Booksellers Association stuff, and Steve Horowitz, the rep from Abraham Associates, was I guess pitching me your book, and I think what I was really kind of irritated about was that I know that he and I had met before.
Mm-hmm.
And I always, as a bookseller, asked about debut novels. I was always very interested in who were the new people coming out.
Right.
And I think I was irritated with the fact that he was selling me your book with that angle. It's a semi-autobiographical, you know,
right.
novel. I was like,
right.
And I think I was very upset with that. Like you'd mentioned before, this idea that publishers have that they need to establish a literary writer's authority by tying the book to their biography in some way.
Right. Yeah. Like, no, and it's annoying because there's some really kind of like crazy stuff that happens in Hick. And so, for instance, when Hick was turned into a movie, the director, you know, when I first met him, he said, you know, you know, I just need to ask you how much of this is, you know. And I was like, you know, honestly, not much. I mean, a lot of it, but the really crazy stuff, you know,
right.
is not. So, yeah.
And here's the worst part about all of that is that after my book came out, and of course, at the time, we also have to from the fact that I was trying to sell my first novel at the time that this happened.
Right.
And
yeah.
My first novel was in no way semi-autobiographical.
Right.
And a lot of my frustration was arising out of the fact that I was thinking that, you know, do I have to, you know, pull like a reverse James Fry and and tell the publisher that I'm really a tiny Asian woman?
Yeah. No, you know? I know. Well, that's the sad and horrible thing is like, with that thing with James Fry, I was so annoyed because I felt like saying, hey, you know what? Oprah is a first time writer, and you know, I knew from experience that everybody around him, his agents, you know, the publishers, everybody is saying, oh,
right.
Come on, just say it's autobiographical, just say it. Or,
right.
You know, oh, it's kind of true, just say it is true. So he did what they were questioning him to do. And of course, then when he got busted, they just like walked away from him like he, you
right.
know, had leprosy. And I knew exactly what happened because I had experienced that kind of pressure. I mean, not that my publisher was doing it, but just that's just what
right.
they do, you know,
yeah.
in general. So, yeah.
So let's back up then and actually talk about the real biography. You were born in Nebraska, is that correct?
No, I was actually
no.
born in Champaign, Illinois.
Ah.
Yeah, and then I was, and then my parents moved when I was about a month old to Austin, and then they got divorced, and my dad moved to South America, to Brasilia and Rio de Janeiro, and we moved with him. So, and then we didn't get back to the States until he went to Duke. So then I was 10 around 7, so 7 to 10 in North Carolina. And then I asked to move in with my mom in Nebraska. So I was in Nebraska from 10 to 17 before I went to Bryn Mawr, where I was 17, I went to Bryn Mawr.
Wow.
Yeah.
Now, what did your parents do that Rio was an option?
My dad is a sociologist, so he's at Princeton now. So he was there doing research and stuff like that. So yeah.
What does your mom do?
She was at the time a stay at home mom. I mean, she has her degree now, but you know, she has three kids. So, and especially when they got divorced, she pretty much had her hands full. You know.
Yeah. I mean. So were there always then books in your family? Always, where did the book writing spark come from, do you think?
Well, my dad he writes books, but they're nonfiction books.
Right.
He writes, you know, books about sociology and all that sort of stuff. But so, you know, and when I was with my dad, when we were with my dad, it was all about, you know, we were always on campuses because he was, you know, he was at Duke, then he was at Johns Hopkins and then Princeton. So if I was with my dad, I was on a campus, and the kind mm-hmm. of like people that he would have, you know, at the dinner parties and stuff were always, you know, academics, not so right. much, writers of fiction, but, you mm-hmm. know, writers of books. And then when I was with my mom, you know, we're in Nebraska, so that was a completely different environment. And when I was little, like when I first moved to Nebraska, we lived on a farm. Mm-hmm. So, and that farm has, by the way, just become sort of like my rosebud, you know, it was like this yellow farmhouse with just tons of land behind it and a right. barn. And we used to get in so much trouble. It was so fun. And then we were kicked off because they built a Blockbuster mall where wow. the farm was. Yeah. So like the ending of Hick is like uh-huh. my sort of like, you know, homage to that and my sort of like my revenge against Blockbuster. But now I'm so happy because they went out of business. I yeah. feel like vengeance is mine.
Yeah, but I don't think you can get the farm back, though. That's the bad
thing. No farm. But, you know, every once in a while, I'll go and I'll start looking at farms and thinking about, like, oh, it'd be great to have a farm in Nebraska, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah. Have you ever been back to where the farm was and looked at the
yeah,
development,
I mean,
and thought, oh, man.
No, I mean, it's actually kind of heartbreaking, to be uh-huh. quite honest, because the farm was, it was beautiful. I mean, it was mm-hmm. just huge. I mean, I don't even know how many acres. It must have been on like 7 acres. Like it was, uh-huh. or maybe even 10. I mean, it was like right. a huge, huge area where, you know, you could build a whole suburban phase in this mm-hmm. area. It was huge.
Right.
And there was just this, you know, old, like 100-year-old yellow farmhouse. And behind it, a barn. There was even a shack and like a pool, but the pool was like a rectangular old fashioned pool that someone had put in like maybe the 30s. And it was just like kids' heaven. And then across from it was a giant cemetery, like a cemetery as far as the eye could see. So we used to all go in there and get scared. That was like our fun thing to do. Because there was five of us. There was my brother Charles, my brother Bobby, my sister Nancy, and my sister Lisa. So it was like wow. we got in lots of trouble.
It sounds a bit like my grandparents' place outside of Augusta, Kansas. And that was 13 acres of land that used to belong to an oil company. And then they pumped everything dry out there. And after the Second World War, my grandfather bought the land with his GI money. And that's where my dad grew up. And the only building on the land when he bought it was this two-story cinder block field station, you know, with an iron staircase going around the outside of it.
Right.
And my grandfather built the family home around that structure. So the core of the house was this cinder block structure.
Right.
And, you know, my dad would tell stories about how when he was real little, the only way you could get upstairs was either outside on the iron staircase, or when he built some of the house around and took that iron staircase off, he had to go through a trap door in the floor up to his bedroom and on the second floor until my grandfather built the interior staircase to get upstairs. And there were five of us grandkids. My dad's sister had three daughters, and then there was me and my sister. And I loved going out there because, you know, you had just this big, you know, empty, nothing piece of land out there. And there was a little creek that ran through it mm-hmm. and what my grandfather called the river bottom. And it was this area that, you know, from erosion, whatever, had been cut out. And there was actually, the house went down and there was a slope. And then there was just like this 50-foot cliff drop off into the river bottom. So it's like, you know, this weird topographical anomaly for Kansas.
Yes, that is strange.
And I loved going out there. You just disappear out there. And, you know, back then in the 70s, they didn't really, you know, they didn't put like wrist braces on you or leashes or anything like that. Well, we could have gotten in trouble, but that was fun.
Oh my God. Yeah. And well, that's so funny. Like when you look back on the way that everything was back then compared to now, It's like seems like everything. You think, what really that was allowed back then?
Right. No helmets, no knee pads.
Yeah, nothing like that. Nothing like that. So that's sort of what that was. And then, but then the new book is coming out, and that's also, you know, actually I would say the new book, Anatomy of a Misfit, is much more close to the reality than,
right.
Yeah.
It sounds like it.
Yeah.
From what I've read, and I've got one on order at Watermark waiting for it to release.
Oh, nice. Very good. Yeah. Nice to hear it.
Hey,
I just did a bunch of radio interviews, actually. So,
oh, yeah?
Yeah, and I'm doing some other ones this week. So,
Yeah, cool. So, you know, you didn't go to Bryn Mawr to major in English or creative writing, did you?
Well, I majored in English literature, but I didn't necessarily have it. It wasn't exactly, you know, a done deal that I would be a writer at all.
I didn't really
think, you know, that I would. But then I sort of ended up basically I went to Bryn Mawr, and then I went to UCSD in film and theater, and then about 10 years I really didn't do anything except for I sort of had this feeling, you know, that I just had been living in an ivory tower.
Uh-huh.
And so I kind of wanted to get out of it. So then for 10 years, I didn't really do much. And then at the end of 10 years, I was annoyed enough with my life that I finally got hit published.
So was the MFA then at San Diego, was that in creative writing or was that in
No,
in
it was just in, it was in film and theater. So it was just, you know, I was just kind of not really, you know, I just wasn't, I was very focused in high school and college and even in that, but then I was a little bit burnt out because I had been a straight A student my whole life. And, and I think that once I graduated with my MFA, I was 25 and I was just sort of like, I was kind of burnt. So I needed like 10 years to recover.
Yeah. Yeah, I can see why. Yeah. And boy, of all the places to distract yourself, you know, Southern California is a good one.
Yeah, definitely. Oh, almost too good in a way. So.
So what did you do during that 10 years? Was that when you worked for, was it Paramount?
Yeah, I worked for Paramount. I was a script reader for Paramount. At the time, they had something called Paramount Classics, which was sort of like their satellite, you know, thing. So basically, you know, every studio has like their small thing, and that one doesn't exist anymore. They have a different one, but you know, at the time that was there, they were trying to make indie movies there. That was kind of supposed to be like their, you know, their Miramax. And so I was a lowly script reader for them. So the scripts back then would be messengered over, and then I would have to say something about them and, you know, something that seemed vaguely interesting, and then, you know, from that.
Are there any movies that that we would know that you got the first peek at on the script end?
There was a bunch of them, and I mean, just if anybody's reading, just so they know, the reader is like the lowest on the totem pole. So basically, and the when I first got there, that I was told your job is to find a reason to say no. So And it wasn't hard. I mean, a lot of the scripts just weren't really that good. But but some of them were really good. Like there was the script called Igby Goes Down by this guy Burr Sears. And he was a writer at the time. I think he directs now also, because he actually ended up directing the movie himself. And it was a great script, which is why he got such a great cast for the movie, even though he had never directed, I don't think. But it was, I was so excited about it. And I'd worked at that time for 3 years, and I had never been that excited. And I read the script. I was so excited. I called my boss. I told him, you know, you have to take this. It's so great. And he's like, you know, is anybody attached to direct? No. Is anybody attached to be in it? No. Okay. Well, you know, whatever. You know, they didn't care.
Right.
You know, if they didn't have a famous person attached or a famous director, it just was like nowhere to go.
Huh.
Yeah. But then if you did, then it's like you would try to say something, you would have to say something nice.
Right.
You know.
Wow.
Yeah.
That sounds kind of brutal.
It is brutal, but it's not. I mean, the thing is, it's just the way that the movies get made is you get someone to be in them. I mean,
right.
That's, if you're looking for millions of dollars, I mean, there's other ways to make movies. Like if you have a script and you know, and it doesn't take much to do it, you could just make it. But the better thing to do is if you have a script, make it really, really cheap to make but make it good enough that you can actually attract real talent. Like that's what Quentin Tarantino did with Harvey Keitel, and everything that he did in terms of making a script that you could shoot for nothing and then making it really good. So if you could get somebody like that to be in it, that's the way to do it. I mean, you know, like the studios don't want to help anybody. They just, they just want people to come to them with a project that looks like it's going to make money. And then they say, okay, good.
Right. So you kind of have to really kind of be in California if you want to write screenplays.
Well, you don't really, like in a way you don't, because if a good screenplay is a good screenplay and you can just send it out. But what's good about it is that if you're here, you're sort of making the kinds of connections that you might be very helpful. You know, like I with Hick, you know, I lived in LA and I had Hick and it was a book and I met someone who optioned it and who got it made and, you know, helped get it made. And I would never have met that person if I was not in LA. So,
right.
You know, that's amazing. Where it helps is just those random connections.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Having said that, like a great script will, I mean, people will get excited about a great script no matter who they are, no matter when, because it's just really very rare.
Yeah. No, I can understand that. It's kind of the way the creative writing industry thing works anymore. I mean, you either do it yourself or, you know, you find someone that's helpful, or you just be flat out more brilliant than anybody else.
Yeah, I mean, it is true. Like if you can make a script or a novel or whatever it is that's just amazingly super brilliant, the people who are there, whether it's a publisher and a literary agent or whatever it is, you know, they will be excited. I mean, that's how they got into, that's why they do what they do, is because they wanted to be excited by new things. And so if you send them something and it's really good, they, you know, they really will be excited about it. It's not like, it's like, that's what they got into the business is to read that manuscript that they've been looking for. So, you know,
Oh yeah, and even then you can be brilliant. You just hit that reader on a wrong day. You know, maybe they had a bad sandwich and have a cold, and
yes, that's true.
And they
true.
Pass on it. You know, I mean, it. It's kind of the way it went for me trying to get Shadows placed. Was it, you know, just one miss after another until I found someone that was like, I get it, and it went off.
Yeah, I mean, you do have to deal with a lot of rejection. I mean, that's part of it. I think a lot of times people don't try because they are scared of rejection, or they try a little bit and then they're rejected, and then they think, oh, and like it can't be like that. You have to say, this is what I'm doing, and then you act as if that's what you're doing, and you just keep doing it until somehow it works. Like, which seems crazy, but it's true. Like, you know, when I finished Hick, I didn't have any connections. So I got the writer's market and I looked up how to query. What do you do? Right. You know, and then I went and I found agents that specialized in, that really were looking for first time novelists. Mm-hmm. So I sent it out to like 10 of them. I would have sent it out to 100, but I just couldn't afford the postage. And so, I mean, that's really where I was coming from. I had no money at the time. And then I got rejections and I got one acceptance, and that's really all you need. And I got a lot of nice no's, you know, but then I got that one, and then, you know, and then I worked with her without any commitment on anybody's mm-hmm. part for like a year. So, wow. you know, I mean, it could have been nothing, but then, you know, right. I really did. I put in the work because I wanted to have the book published, even if I had to put in a year in these circumstances, and I did. But, mm-hmm. you know, I mean, but in terms of acting as if it's going to happen, like this is a good sort of example. So I right. remember very clearly I had a photographer come over and take my author photo, okay, which seems completely insane. Like, why would you do that when you had right. no book, no commitment? I mean, I was working with the agent, but that could have turned into nothing, you know? But it was sort of like my way of telling the universe that, like, I'm doing this no matter what. Right, and right. And that photo, it's so funny, I just realized this last night. That photo is in the New York Times book review yesterday on the entire page spread they did for Anatomy of a Mystery. Yep. I know. Crazy,
oh,
right?
No.
Yeah. I know. And I remember even like one of my friends was teasing me like, oh, you're getting your picture taken, whatever. Like you're getting your author photo taken. You're a nerd. Like, what are you talking about? And like, but that just goes to show, like,
right.
you know.
So how long did it take you to find the agent?
Well, I, at the time that photo, said photo was being taken, I had the agent was, we were working in this non-committal mm-hmm. way.
Right.
So I sort of, you know, kind of like geared up at a certain point because I think I had a really horrible breakup or something. Like I was just, mm-hmm. it was just like something infuriated me enough that I actually got it together to really complete it. And you know, she loved it. And then she went out and dealt with a lot of rejection too,
right.
you know, and, but then she found one miraculous bite and then we were off to the races. Mm-hmm. You know,
and that was Unbridled.
Yeah, that was Fred Raimi and Unbridled. Yeah. Thank God for him. And he also, you know, he edited the book, and I'll never forget it. You know, like he liked it, and he, but he wanted to make sure that I would, you know, that he could work with me.
Right.
So
right.
you know, my agent had to call me and be like, "Will you work with him?" And you know, of course, my answer was yes. Of course, I will. And and so then he gives a bunch of notes, and then. You know, my agent reads me the note. And so then for like the next hour, I'm like swearing, you know, like walking up and down, like, you know, like just like freaking out, not to my agent, but just in general to, you know, just
right.
like, what the hell, you know, he doesn't get it, you know, all the stupid stuff. And then like the next day, I'm like, yeah, he's right. And he was right, you know, and then I go, take
yeah.
it. And by the way, that's the part of the process. Like that happens with every book.
Oh, yeah.
It happened with Barry the Hint. It happened with Anatomy of a Mist, that like you get uh-huh. the notes and you think like, you're a jerk. And then, and you like,
right,
and then
right.
you're like, oh yeah, and then and you get it out, you vent, and then the next day you say, oh yeah, you were right, you know, you were
yeah.
right.
It, yeah, you, yeah, it's that weird little psychological trigger nobody knows is there. The editor or the publisher says yes, and you think, yay, I've made it. Why the criticism?
Yeah,
right?
Exactly. Like, why are you criticizing? I thought you wanted, you know, and like you just have to take it as long as. I find that with this stuff, like you take the editor's notes, one person, one editor, you take 90% of the notes and then 10% mm-hmm. you don't take because, you know, they're not always right. So like there
right.
will be some things that aren't right. But I think if you do about 90% of them, you're good. I think if
yeah.
you do 100% of them, then I think they think you're kind of a sucker. So I think
right,
you have
right.
to like, you have to kind of, there's, you've got to stick to like 10% of.
Yeah.
yeah,
it's about finding what notes they've given you fit with your vision of the novel and then tweaking what you can so that they see the rest of it and those other notes can be thrown out. That's
right.
kind of what I've found is, you know, they it's something that I do when I look at other people's work and when I edit or talk to someone, it's like, listen, if you want to do this, then you should try these steps. But if you're really wanting to try this, whatever your intent is, maybe you might try this. You know, it's just kind of something I developed after all those crazy, ridiculous workshops, you know, trying to get an MFA and, you know, majoring in creative writing as an undergrad and everything is that it was easier to give people options than to act like I knew everything.
Right. Yeah, no, and I think people appreciate that. You know, I think it's like I think that's really sort of the way to do it.
think that's what makes a good editor. I think that's why I like working with Fred so much.
Yeah, well, he's great. I mean, I've been lucky, like with Fred and with Dan Matanka at Sasko, and then with Kristen Pettit and at mm-hmm. HarperCollins. Like, I've just been really lucky. I've had great editors who elevated the work, you know,
right.
Which is obviously what we all hope for.
Exactly. Yeah, I think that's probably one of those really, really important steps that I might get in trouble for this because I already did sort of. This thing that's one of the steps that a lot of self-publishers miss
is what?
That value of an editor, of someone
yeah.
who's doing it professionally,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to, you know, their buddy down the street who they pay in beer.
Yeah, no, I know. I mean, that's like, it's really a necessary step to have mm-hmm. those outside eyes and to have the outside eyes of somebody who really knows what they're doing. I mean, and the nice thing is now when I'm writing, I know that I will have an editor that will fix something that's broken. So I don't
right.
have to be too scared. Like, I don't have to be fearful of the writing mm-hmm. process because I know that ultimately there's someone eventually that's going to fix it if it's broken. Because sometimes you don't even know if it's broken. Sometimes you think, I don't know if this is working. So it's nice to
right.
know that, you know, you're going to have somebody who does know.
Maybe that's my block. Maybe that's what I haven't quite grasped yet. Because, you know, most of what Fred worked on with mine was the ending. There weren't a whole lot of edits that were made early on, just a lot of work on the ending.
Right.
Because I beat up my characters, so there needed to be some kind of lift at the end.
Right. Right.
Yeah. And I don't know that... And, you know, I spent so long, every time I got rejected, this was probably a useless endeavor, but maybe not. Every time I got rejected, whether it was a form rejection or not, I sat down and revised the novel.
Oh, yeah, that's not a good idea.
Right, right. I don't plan on doing that again. It was probably why it took me, you know, 7 years to sell it.
Yeah, you do not want to do that every time. No way.
No.
No.
Things we learn, right? Just from
yeah,
being
exactly.
stupid.
I mean, because, you know, everybody's going to have their own opinion. So mm-hmm. you definitely don't want to just, you know what I mean? You just have to find somebody who you feel like they get it.
Right.
And then everything they do will be fine. But, like, at least they got it.
Hmm.
Like, they get the gist of it, you know?
Right, right. Do you want to spill the beans about your connection that optioned the film? How did that work? I mean, I'm curious.
Oh,
because,
yeah, no, it's
you know,
actually kind of interesting.
One of those things that just fascinates me because I think, you know, that's how do I get there? I asked Fred once what I need, and he said I need a treatment. I said, how the hell do I write a treatment?
Well, it's a little, I mean, it's hard. I mean, this is one of those things that has to do with being in LA. Like, so mm-hmm. I have a friend, we've known each other forever, and he just happens to be a really successful screenwriter. So he actually read my second book, Bury This,
mm-hmm.
And he really loved it. You know, he was sort of going crazy for it and was saying, oh my God, you know, I love this, blah, blah, blah. And let's go take it out there. Let's pitch it. And I
right.
kind of said, actually, I think there's a different one that you're going to want to go out with more. And I think that it's more commercial and I just think it's more timely. So let's
mm-hmm.
do that. So he seems kind of like, huh, okay. And then of course he read it and he thought, oh, he was like, oh, okay, I get it. You know, like he understood why that was, why I felt like that was what we should do. So we went out, actually, instead of sending the book out, we pitched it. Because the mm-hmm. thing is, people in Hollywood really don't like to read books. They just don't have that
right.
much time, and they just don't, you know what I mean? They just don't.
Right.
So we basically just took the book in and into them, you know? And,
right.
And he pitched it, and he's, you know, really great at that, and that's, like, one of his things to do. His name is Joel Silverman, and he's got a lot of projects right now that are with really big people, like, you know, John Turteltaub and I can't believe I'm blanking on his name, Jerry Bruckheimer. And seriously, Jerry Bruckheimer, you know what I mean? Like, he has big people that he's doing projects with. So, and he's very good at pitching. So we went in, we pitched it, and then it was kind of crazy what happened. Like, it became a little bit of like a huge thing. Like, all of a sudden everybody wanted it.
So, yeah, I remember hearing about it.
Yeah, so it was a little bit crazy. And then and then we actually got a preemptive, meaning that they were paying us to take it off the table from Paramount. So we did that, and we didn't still pitch it anymore. And that was sort of what happened.
Wow. Now, didn't you help write or co-write the screenplay?
No, I will be co-writing it with Joel. Yeah, we're doing it together. Yeah.
Okay. Oh, for Bury This?
No, for Anatomy of the Missing.
Oh.
That's the one we pitched, and that's the one that Paramount bought. Yeah.
Oh, so, I thought we were talking about Hick.
No, Hick was different. Hick was optioned by my friend Christian Taylor, and then we sort of went forward with that. And that again was just, you know, a friendship that ended up, you know, with this amazing thing happening.
Cool.
So again, I mean, these both were basically happening because of being in LA.
Yeah, I need to get to New York or LA.
Well, I mean, the thing about being in New York in LA is that, you know, you kind of can't swing a dead cat without bumping into somebody who is a producer, wants to be a producer.
Right.
And wants material. So then what that becomes is, you know, when you have a book, all of a sudden everybody's like, you know, like, oh, what's your book about? And then next thing you know, it's like, you know, it's people are looking for content. They're looking for material. So, you know, a producer is looking for something to produce. And the other thing is that it's actually easier to sell a book than a screenplay. People have more respect for it. Mm-hmm. In Hollywood, they think, oh, it was a book, you know, and also that means it has the mark of somebody else's approval,
right?
You know, like, oh, this somebody approved of this enough to make it into a book, so therefore it's kind of got that sound,
right? And so there's already an established audience to some degree that might go and pick it up as a movie as well.
Yeah, well, there's also like the idea, there's kind of like a mentality that they always want to make sure somebody else likes something before they can like it. So, so like there's a joke my friend told me, which is, I think is just so funny, which is that like everybody gets a script over the weekend that's, you know, supposedly very hot. And then, you know, and then on Monday, you know, an assistant comes in and, you know, asks his boss, you know, his boss, the agent, like, you know, what did you think of the script? What did you think of the script? And he's like, I don't know. I haven't talked to anybody yet. You know, and that's kind of how it is. Like, people really need to know, like, they really do. You know, there are obviously people who can, you know, who you know, can make their own opinion about things. But, but people really do feel like they need to talk to someone before they know. So a book has the seal of approval that, you know, someone made it.
Kind of have to engage the hive mind before you step out.
Yeah. So, yeah.
So how did you have Bury This written when Hick sold?
No, I wrote Bury This when I was pregnant with my son Wyatt, and I just kind of didn't have enough to do. I was, you know, so bored because I was, you know, when you're pregnant, you can't do anything. So basically,
well, you're working hard at gestating. There's no shame.
Yeah, no, but you're not going out anywhere. You're not. So I had all of this free time, and so I became obsessed with the story. I actually saw it on something. I think I saw it on TV or something crazy. Mm-hmm. And I became obsessed with it, with the story. And then I decided to sort of take it and I was kind of inspired by it. And that was that.
What story? Cause I've, I think Rebecca gave, when Rebecca and I were still together, she gave me a galley of Bury This, and I put it on my two reed shelf, which actually grows exponentially every month. And I went out and, when the book came out, I bought a copy because I always like to throw in my money to support my friends. And finally have gotten around to starting it almost, what has it been? 9 months almost since it came out.
Yeah.
That's how my cycle goes.
Yeah.
So you said this came from an actual event. What was the event?
Yeah. There was this story happened in the 70s in Michigan, and not in the same city. I mean, and the names and everything, all that stuff has changed because right. I made up characters sort of out of Volkoff, but I took the basics of the event. So that's kind of how that worked. I don't want to give too much away. It has to do with a murder and a cold case. Mm-hmm. And then basically what happened is, and this is true, the students at a local college decided to do a documentary on this cold case. And then eventually, because the documentary happened in the town, all of a sudden a cop became reinterested in the case, and then solved it.
Wow.
And then the thing about the solving of it was that it was so insane. They had thought it was just a serial killer.
Right.
And then what it was so much worse than that.
Oh, wow.
Okay. That it was like unfathomable. I mean, this is why I became obsessed, because I really couldn't believe it.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's just...
I love coming across stories like that. That's kind of how I got obsessed with what became my first novel was, you know, the whole Srebrenica massacre thing. Just could not get that out of my head.
Yeah, exactly. So that was sort of, so that's what happened. And I guess people can read about it to see what happened. And then they can read because actually what happened was so bad that I even made it nicer in the book. Because it was so so crazily bad. So I mean, you know, but it's not nice even in the book. I mean, people that read the book think, "Oh my God, this is so dark. What's wrong with you?"
Okay, well, yeah. I'm looking forward to getting through it. That's gonna be good. oh my.
Yeah.
So what drove you? Well, I got about three different things I want to ask, and I don't know where to start right now.
Okay.
Okay, let me see if I can get my head around everything here. What would you say your obsession is? Because from what I've gathered, Hick, which I've read, Bury This, which I'm reading, the stories and what's going on in them is drastically different, but every writer kind of has an obsession, thematically or whatever. What would you say yours is?
Oh boy, there's so many, but I just feel like I really do like sort of like lowbrow kinds of stories. I just do, but I'm not really sure. I mean, they all seem to have to do with girls, and they all seem to have to do with, you know, kind of young girls, and they're all pretty dark. But it's not one of those things where I would say, oh, you know, this is my thing. I mean, so many things I just get sort of weirdly obsessed with, you know. So I'm not sure what it would be. So far, I mean, all three books have to do with girls that are young.
Right.
I mean, in Hicks, she's 13. In Bury This, they're in their 20s.
Mm-hmm.
And then in Anatomy, she's 16. So, you know, and they all do have sort of dark things going on.
Right. Right.
So, like, I wouldn't write a novel that was set in the, I can't see myself writing, like, a novel that was set during Victorian times about, like, parlor, like, manners.
Right.
Like, I can't see that happening, you know?
Right.
So there's that. But I'm not sure. Like, I can't see anything. I mean, maybe you could tell me. I don't know.
Maybe I will. When I get done with Bury This, I'll let you know. I mean, I would have, if I were in Steve Horowitz's position trying to sell a book to someone like me, I would have tried to angle Hick as kind of like a rural version of Lolita told from Lolita's point of view.
Right. Well, that would have been a very, very smart way to
you
do
know?
It.
And, you know, and with Bury This, I'm not sure yet. I'm early on in it. But of course I tend to be drawn towards kind of dark things,
mm-hmm.
To begin with, you know, I think the human experience is more sharply defined through tragedy than anything else.
Right.
You really kind of, you, do you ever, I'm sure you saw the, that Joss Whedon series Firefly, right?
No, I didn't. No. Why was I supposed to?
No, I was just curious because there's this fictional philosopher, psychopath that they, or it might not be fictional. I don't know. I've never done any research on it, who is supposed to have had some adage or saying that, you know, you live with a man for, 40 years, you know, get to know him and talk to him. And then one day you take him up to the edge of a volcano and hold him over it. And then you will see the real person.
Wow.
And this is coming from the lips of a sadomasochistic gangster in the story, mm-hmm. that likes to torture people.
Mm-hmm.
which creepily I kind of identify with, which is, you know, what I do to my characters. Who are these people really? And, you know,
right.
How much, what's revealed about them through some kind of, you know, tragedy or suffering.
Right.
So I guess maybe my obsession is sadism, but that's a little too reductive.
Well, I mean, they always say you're supposed to take your protagonist and put them through, you know, basically put them through the worst of the worst and then, mm-hmm. to sort of see what happens. And then, you know, basically the question then is like, do they come out of it? Do you give them hope? Do you give people hope? Do you have them come out of it in a way that people can, you know, or what do? Do you, do they just say it? Like, what do you do? But you are supposed to sort of beat up your protagonist. Otherwise,
yeah.
You don't have a story.
Well, you did that very well in Hick. I was quite shocked at times what Luli went through.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny, it's always more shocking to guys than it is to girls, and I think that's because a lot of girls have had experiences like this.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, I came up, you know, when I was on my book tour for Hick, I had a lot of people, you know, come up to me and say, you know, that they, you know, they had similar experiences, and
really?
That they really wanted to talk about it, and they really wanted, you know, and it was really something that had happened and all of that. And then, you know, but then it was sort of funny, like when the movie came out, you know, the older males were like, oh, this is so horrible. And, and women, and like, this is a perverted fantasy. And then, but women never saw it like that. They're like, oh my God, I totally get this movie. So,
mm-hmm.
I just think, you know, women have very different experiences of the world, and unfortunately, you know, there's a lot of bad things that happen in the world, and a lot of things that happen in the world are in this weird gray area, and women are hip to it because they've experienced it. But I think a lot of guys just have no clue.
Yeah, they have the privilege to be oblivious.
Yeah, and they haven't been a teenage girl. I mean, if you're a teenage girl, I mean, what happens to a lot of teenage girls, happened to me, is that, you know, I was just sort of like a calm girl. And then I kind of like, you know, turned into a girl basically overnight in a way. Like all of a sudden I didn't have my calm girl body. I didn't have any of that. It was all changed. And I was the same. But, like, the entire world treated me differently.
Right. And everything just shifted.
Yeah, and it was scary, actually. And you know, obviously not everything in the book happens in real life or anything, but the way that the world treated me was scary enough. I mean, I know that other people had horrible things happen to them. And so I sort of feel like, you know, I mean, I just kind of feel like this stuff happens a lot more than people care to admit.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's one of the things, I think it's one of the reasons that men should read women writers more often.
Yeah. That's
you know?
That's a good point.
You know, and, you know, we can't help who our favorite, I don't think there's a way there's some kind of resonance that happens between us and our favorite writers.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, I don't think we should hold writers up and criticize them. You know, if all of their favorite writers are men or all of them are women, that shouldn't be the problem. But whether or not they do read, there are lots of women writers that I love to read. There's you, Emily Mandel. There's a romance writer that I like to read every now and then, Teresa Romaine.
Mm-hmm.
And just throw stuff out there, read it, get a little bit of experience.
Right.
But, you know, I'm a guy. I think, and when I look at my list of favorite writers, it skews towards men.
Right.
And I've thought a lot about that. You know, why is that? What is it about the men writers that when I think about which books would I want to have on a desert island, there's, you know, 8 men and 2 women. Why is that?
Well, I mean, I don't know. I mean, some of my writers are like, you know, like I love Joyce Carol Oates. The book Blonde, I think, is like the most beautiful, flawless book. And then, you know, I love Shakespeare, and I have a copy of Hamlet. I have both Blonde and Hamlet next to my bed. And if I need inspiration, that's kind of where I go to.
Yeah, I think, you know, I think my answer to my question, or my solution to my dilemma has been to go out and look for women writers, just to find that one that starts to resonate.
Right. I mean, I've always said there's a couple of my favorite authors that are males, like Philip Roth and Kurt Vonnegut. You know, I mean, there's definitely people that I just, you know, that I'm crazy about that are guys, you know. And then there's guy writers that I think are ridiculous. But the same thing with women writers. I mean, some women writers, you know, I think, like Joyce Carol Oates, I think is like, she can, I love her novels. I think she can, in a way, I feel like she can do no wrong. And then, then, you know, there are women writers that I read and I just think, oh God, this is horrible.
Right.
You know? Right. So for me, it's sort of like hit or miss.
Mm-hmm. Have you read anything by Bobby Louise Hawkins?
No, I haven't.
Oh, her stuff's kind of hard to find. She mostly published with Coffee House Press and Coach House Press out of Canada. She's associated with Anne Waldman and Allen Ginsberg and, you know, the Beats. She was actually married to Robert Creeley for a while back in the 50s and 60s.
Mm-hmm.
She's got a couple of very small novellas, and then some weird kind of hybrid stuff that was performed as a one-woman show. I love her work. She was, of course, my advisor in graduate school.
Right.
But I love to tell people about her. I think she's absolutely brilliant. But almost nobody knows who she is, because she just kind of hides away at Naropa, and she's in her 80s now, and But she grew up in West Texas, and then through, you know, various circumstances or whatever, ended up marrying a diplomat and living in Japan and in England, and, you know, just got this really broad international education. And so she's just got this very regal, you know, way she carries herself and holds herself, and this very precise way of speaking. And of course, cheekbones like the Himalayas, they're massive, you know. So she's gorgeous. And, you know, she has very precise insights into the human condition that that I tend to go back to. I have a quote of hers that was just in conversation during one of the summer writing programs. She just kind of leaned back in her chair and she goes, "Your organism will inform you that you suck." So I keep that posted on the corkboard above my desk just to keep myself in check.
Oh, wow. Yeah. No, well, I will definitely check her out.
I can send you some links.
Yeah, that'd be great.
So what made you switch gears and go young adult?
The story was actually something that I wanted to talk about because it was something that actually happened to me. So I felt like it happened to my friend, and I felt like I really wanted to tell his story. It has to do with gun violence, which is something that I think is really very topical. And, you know, and actually after Sandy Hook, I really felt like I needed to tell the story. So,
yeah. It's interesting that there's, I guess I want to, was it the hope that by by moving it to young adult, you could reach that younger audience with this, that thing?
No, I mean, there was actually no sort of like conscious sort of effort. It was really just like, I just felt like this was the way that the novel wanted, that the story wanted to be told.
Okay.
You know, sort of like fitting the form to the content in a way, which is something that I really, you know, that I really like to do. Like, and so I felt like this was exactly the way to do it. And that's kind of how I did it, you know?
Okay. Yeah. It seems like there are some people that choose to go YA just because that's the thing to do now.
Yeah, no, it's true. And I think that usually shows. I think that you can tell if somebody's, you know, if they're just doing it because they think that that's the going thing, or that that's what's going to sell. I think that shows in the work, and I think, you know, I've read a couple of those, I think that, you know, if your heart is not in it, and if you're not, you know, seeing it, you know, for what it is, and sort of respecting it as a form, and you're just kind of like, oh, this is going to sell. I don't think you're going to make anything very good.
Right.
Because it's not, you know, that's not the way to make anything.
Right.
You know, the way to make something is to be passionate about it and to really care about it. And and I feel like, you know, if somebody's idea is, you know, well, this is how you do it because this is how you're going to make some money, then I think, you know, that's when you get in trouble.
Yeah. Not that you can't make money. I mean, I think the thing when I get, when I talk about why I won't self-publish, the people that beat me up are the self-publishers who are all about, you know, well, if you want to be making money and be financially independent as a writer, it's like, you know, I want to tell interesting stories, but I also consider it an art form. And, you know, you're not, you can create a formula and paint by numbers, or you can, you know, explore the form and learn how to bend it and twist it and still do something that grabs people.
Yeah. I mean, I think having things like an editor, like we said, are very important. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, I'm happy if somebody can self-publish and that works for them, but it's just not where I wouldn't trust myself to create something without having somebody else there to help me shape it, you know?
Right, right. Yeah, to see those gaps and ask you, well, did you mean to do this?
Right. And you know how it is when you're writing something and you think like, I think this is kind of wonky, but I don't want to admit it to myself kind of thing. And right. And then, you know, your publisher, your editor will come along and be like, hey, you know that thing? Here's what I think. And you're like, Yeah, and you're like, yeah, that was the thing I was kind of trying to pretend was okay, and it's not. So I would be scared for what I would do without someone there to keep me in check like that.
Right, right.
You know, and to say, yeah, you know that thing? It's really not working, you know? Or like, why did you do this? This seems so weird, you know? Mm. What are you trying to hide? Shouldn't it be that, right. You know what I mean? That stuff. Or just simple things. Like sometimes you assume somebody knows something and it's completely obvious to you as the writer. You think, oh, well, of course they know.
Right.
And then the editor says, no, I didn't understand that relationship. Really? You need to make that I did not understand. And you think, well, what do you mean? It's obvious. And they're like, no, it's not. It's maybe as obvious in your head, but
exactly. Yeah.
You know, so I mean, I need an editor.
Are you rushed for time? Do you have a few more minutes?
I'm a little bit rushed. I actually have to go pick Wyatt up from his school, his pre-K, but I have a little bit of time if you want to ask.
Kind of my last question that I tend to like to ask everybody. And it has to do, you know, with, you know, every year we kind of, the NEA and other groups kind of fall all over themselves, you know, saying, oh, literary reading is dying. Mm. And some people go, well, no, it's not. Take a look at all of this stuff going on. And to me, whether it's dying or not, it seems that as writers, as producers of books, we should be incredibly concerned with maintaining the ecosystem. Mm-hmm. and being engaged with readers, not just in to sell our own books, but to broaden the possible audience.
Mm-hmm.
So I always like to know what writers think writers should be doing beyond just writing good books to feed the tree, so to speak, to call back to the belly band from like 1990 something.
I don't know. I think that, you know, the days of just being able to write your book and just kind of like hide away are over. I mean, you have to do things like get out there and be on social media and be connecting with people. You just kind of do.
Right.
So I think that, that's one of the things that people need to do. And then, you know, I mean, quite frankly, I think that people are interested in, people do become interested in things that, you know, get turned into movies and all of that. So, you know, I mean, there is content that is needed. People need to make movies, whether it's the studios or on Netflix or whatever. So, you know, I think making yourself uncomfortable and, you know, making and saying like, okay, you know, making those decisions after you write the book about how trying to see how the book could get turned into something, I think is important, because then it's like, then you make it into another form and then people want to see that form and then they want to go back and read the book. I mean, Hick sells a lot because it was a movie, and those people go and they find the book and they get interested in me or whatever they get interested in, but they do seem to get interested because of that. And so in a way it's like you kind of have to find different platforms and not just be married to, you know, the old idea. There are other ways to kind of get things out there.
Cool. Yeah. Excellent. Well, I will let you go and rush off to pick up Wyatt at the daycare.
Yeah, get Wyatt at pre-K. Mm-hmm.
Andrea, thank you very much for taking the time to talk with me today.
Oh, thanks for talking to me. I'll talk to you soon.
Okay. Oops. All right, there you have it, my conversation with Andrea Portes. I hope you enjoyed that. I had a good time talking to her. Of course, in 2 weeks, we'll have another Shop Talk with Laura Holly. Maybe we'll try and grab someone else and make it a triangle. And then after that, I'm not sure. I've got a few things in the fire, but somewhere down the road, we're going to have the poet Taylor Molly on here. I'm hoping that works out. Cross your fingers, and maybe we shouldn't talk about that. Anyway, see you in a couple of weeks.